October 15th and 16th, St. Scholastica Academy in Chicago hosted a conference titled Nuclear Power and Children's Health. Sponsored by a coalition of peace and anti-nuclear groups, the conference focused on the detrimental health effects nuclear power plants have on children. Hallways and the balcony outside the conference were lined with gruesome pictures of deformed and mentally disabled children born to survivors of the Chernobyl accident in the Ukraine. Dr. Helen Caldicott, president of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, says such a catastrophe could happen here. Therefore, Illinois' 14 nuclear power plants constitute an imminent threat to Chicago.
It's not if, but when there's a meltdown. Now, there are 103 reactors in America, but you're surrounded by 14, and they're pretty old, the reactors here. And if one of them melts down, that's the end of Chicago, if the wind is blowing towards Chicago.
Do you think this is should be a primary concern of Mayor Daley?
Absolutely. There could be no other more important concern for Mayor Daley, because I don't know what the risk is. Some mathematicians might be able to work it out, but it's like in medicine. You might come in, I might not quite know what's wrong with you. I have to watch you overnight. Tomorrow you might sort of manifest more clearly your disease. And we can never predict in medicine really what's going to happen to a patient. Unusual things happen, and we have to be ready for that. It's the same with these nuclear power plants.
You never hear about this in the newspapers. It's never discussed in Chicago. Very rarely, anyway. And when it is discussed, this issue is sort of put down like, well, people are just fear-mongering. Nothing has happened so far. Why should we be worried about this?
Well, I love that argument, nothing's happened so far, therefore, because it hasn't happened so far, it won't happen again. It's like, well, I haven't got cancer so far, you know, I won't get cancer. Or I had an old man who came into me years ago in the emergency room. He'd broken his neck, and he was nearly dead. And he said, I've been driving for 60 years, and I've never had an accident. But he did that night, you see? And if there is an accident, and there's a possibility that there could be, and it's not low, then what are you going to do when you've got hundreds of thousands of people with acute radiation sickness, you know, with severe nausea, vomiting, bloody diarrhea, their hair falling out in big clumps and dying within 2 weeks of massive infection or hemorrhage? I mean, they can say, well, you know, it hadn't happened before, but now it's happened.
Mm-hmm. Some people would say, well, your problem is that you have no compromise. You just want to get rid of all nuclear power, and there has to be a compromise somewhere.
I don't have a problem. I'm a physician. I have no problem. I took the Hippocratic Oath. Nuclear power is medically contraindicated, not just because these reactors pour out millions of curies of radiation in an unregulated way every year, but because there could be a meltdown, which could mean the end of Chicago, and because these reactors can create massive quantities of radioactive waste, hundreds of thousands of tons, which are going to last for up to a million years. No one knows where to put it. And this material is very biologically active. If strontium-90, for instance, leaks into water, which it will over time, and gets into the food chain, it bioconcentrates thousands of times at each step. And unfortunately, or fortunately, our senses weren't evolved to be able to taste strontium-90 in fish, or to smell it, or to see it. So we don't know when we're eating radioactive material. Like if the power plants that put out routinely all this radiation into the air every day, if you could see it, you'd understand. If you could smell it, you could understand. But you can't. It's invisible and tasteless and odorless. And in that sense, it's so dangerous. And then when your cancers appear, they don't wear little signs saying what made them, like, when you ate some strontium-90 in a piece of fish 20 years ago, or cesium-137, that the cancer does not identify its origin. But there are more and more reported cases of cancer clusters around old nuclear power plants now, because the incubation time for cancer is any time for 5 to 60 years, whereas for a cold, it's 2 days. For measles, it's 3 weeks. And that's how the nuclear power gets away with its perfidy, because A, these materials cannot be picked up by the human senses, are undetectable, and B, because cancers do not identify their origins. But almost certainly, these nuclear reactors, 103 of them in America, are contributing to the increased rates of cancer and particularly in children who are very much more sensitive to radiation than adults. Mm-hmm.
The energy industry says that it's not practical to get rid of nuclear power, that we've put so much investment in it that now we're getting 20% of our energy from it, so there's no way we can make that up any other
way.
That's
ridiculous. If you all stopped using your clothes dryers and hung your clothes out in the sun in the summer and by your furnace in the winter, then much of the electricity made from nuclear power would not be necessary. If you decided to conserve, turned off every light in your house except that in the room in which you're operating, turned off your TVs, your VCRs, your computers at night, and stopped being so wasteful with energy, you would have the same standard of lifestyle as you have now, because the Europeans use 50% less electricity than you do and have the same standard of living. Anyway, nuclear power is totally subsidized by the federal government. You can't buy insurance for a nuclear accident for yourself or your house or your property. That says everything. The enrichment of uranium is paid for by the federal government, extraordinarily expensive and energy consuming. Nuclear power makes global warming gases, contrary to what the nuclear industry is saying. It makes massive quantities of carbon dioxide throughout the whole fuel cycle. It makes 93% of the chlorofluorocarbon gas, which is the main destroyer of the ozone layer and also a very potent global warming gas. And then continuously, as I've said, it releases massive quantities of radiation in an unrestricted way into the air every year. So what the nuclear industry says is a lie. And I believe that the FCC and the FTC must step in, because we can't have terribly medically dangerous industries telling lies to the American people. And that's why the physicians have to take a stand and say this is medically contraindicated. Every single nuclear power plant around Chicago must be shut down immediately. We've got an acute clinical emergency on our hands.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott, president of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute. Her newest book is The New Nuclear Danger, George W. Bush's Military-Industrial Complex. The worst nuclear accident in the U.S. happened at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania in 1979. That accident galvanized the anti-nuclear movement, and no new nuclear power plants have been built since. The government contends that no one was harmed by the accident, but many, including Mary Osborne Osai, a longtime resident of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, near the Three Mile Island facility, have documented the many casualties of that accident.
Unless you live through the terrifying days and weeks of the accident at Three Mile Island, you'll never be able to understand or relate to how we felt then and how we feel now. Sounds, smells, voices, and words have been etched within us. The voice of commentator Walter Cronkite on the evening news announcing the accident to the world and to Harrisburg. The sounds of sirens or church bells ringing instantly flashes back to March 30th, 1979, known as Black Friday, a day of uncontrolled radiation releases and evacuation. The incredible metallic taste or smell, the saltiness, the thiosulfate peroxide smells, and the dead fishy smell remind us of something evil that destroyed our happy way of life. We remember the voices of our children and our inability as parents to protect them from the invisible, unforgiving poisons in our air, and remember our neighbors downriver exposed to the radioactive reprocessing grade water dumped from TMI into the Susquehanna River, from which their water for drinking and bathing was obtained. Other voices introduced us to the second disaster at Three Mile Island, exposing dishonesty and betrayal by those entrusted with protecting our health and safety. The utilities Jack Herbine telling us that everything is under control, and later finding out from the lieutenant governor that it's not under control, that we'd been lied to. And the voice of Governor Richard Thornburgh on the third day of the accident, who reluctantly advised those most susceptible, the pregnant women and preschool-aged children living within 5 miles of the reactor, to evacuate, while ignoring those of us living beyond the five-mile zone receiving doses as though there was a magic wall that would stop the radiation. Even voices that we didn't hear had an impact. The mountains of transcripts and audio-taped voices of the NRC commissioners, who never wanted responsibility to order any evacuation then and who still don't want that responsibility now. Voices kept silent at the NRC, knowing leak rates were falsified for 1/2 year prior to the accident at TMI. Those voices never ordered MedEd to shut down the reactor as required by their own laws. During the first days of the accident, we did not know that solid reactor fuel was melting into liquid and flowing like hot olive oil, or that TMI was venting, burping, and dumping radioactivity into our communities, our river, and our bodies. But our bodies knew, and the animals knew. Our bodies reacted by displaying symptoms and effects. The metallic taste or smell, burning or reddening of skin, burning in nose or throat, itching or tearing of eyes, the nausea, vomiting, subsequent diarrhea, and hair loss. Birds died, many of our pets and farm animals died, and many were born deformed. Flowers and leaves started growing deformed and mutated, and many trees died. They continue to do so. To this day, the symptoms have never been investigated. To this day, the nuclear industry prostitutes continue to deny that TMI caused harm to any living thing. If Three Mile Island didn't do it, then what did? Nothing else ever happened in central Pennsylvania to cause those effects. Thousands of people during the accident called the governor's hotline, and Three Mile Island Alert had a telephone log listing a full range of radiation symptoms. A state representative wrote a letter to the NRC asking why they refused to look into these effects. The NRC's Harold Denton issued the now classic response that not enough radiation escaped to cause any of the effects reported. Living on the bank, the west bank of the Susquehanna River, Bill Widdock, who was the first civilian eyewitness to the accident, was startled by the roar of steam blowing out of TMI around 4 a.m. Bill had the metallic taste, developed skin cancer, and his wife developed breast cancer. They were plaintiffs in the consolidated personal injury lawsuits, which the attorneys reluctantly had to withdraw from because the judge threw out all the expert witnesses. Bill died of cancer. While preparing to milk the cows, Marie Holoka of Zion's View was engulfed by a strange blue air. She was choked and could hardly breathe. She fell to the ground. She was sick for days. Many of her cows died after the accident, and guinea fowl eggs would not hatch. Marie developed a thyroid problem, breast cancer, and later cancer around her heart, and she has also died. Louise Hardison had many problems after the accident. Goats, chickens, cats, and rabbits died on her farm across the road from TMI. Stillborn lambs and some rabbits were deformed. They didn't have all their legs. Louise has also died. Her farm was sold, and mutated dandelions still grow in the unfarmed pasture. On a hill 8 miles northwest of TMI, dentists Klein and Malcody found that all of their dental x-ray films taken of their patients' teeth for the first 2 days of the accident were fogged or banded. They taped new film on the front door for the next week and found nothing wrong with those, so they concluded they received the highest doses during the first 2 days. Farmer Claire Hoover and his wife Ruth lost 12 cows and 9 calves shortly after the accident. Some of the animals were taken to the New Bolton Center lab to find the cause of death. The results never came, and neither did the bill, and they learned later that the state had paid the bill. Other tests conducted showed their cattle were found to have elevated white blood counts, the eosinophils. Coincidentally, a group of doctors at Hershey Med Center also found many of their patients had this elevated weight count. In 1985, the Hoovers and their children received out-of-court settlements in the first round of lawsuits for over $200,000. The Hoovers were Mennonites. The church asked them to stop talking about TMI. The milk company told them to quit talking about their problems with the animals or they would not buy milk from them. Eventually, out of 100 cows, 27 died or had a problem, those that were in the pasture. Most calves died. The cows that were in the barn were okay. Their St. Bernard dog and pony died later due to respiratory problems. Helicopters flew over their farm, and someone always knew when to take away a dead animal. One time they hid a calf and had their vet autopsy it before the NRC could find out. They also hid the remains. It had damaged lung, damaged liver, and lungs that never opened. McDonald's used to buy the cows at auction, and the government bought the cows from McDonald. The Hoovers found this out by inquiring why they never received their paychecks. Fran Kane, who still lives across the road from the cooling towers at TMI, had the metallic taste. She later had a poodle puppy born with no eyes, and she received an uncontested settlement during the first round of lawsuits. Bill and Darla Peters, who Steve Wing spoke about yesterday, had a bitter metallic taste so strong they couldn't drink enough water to get rid of it. They had burnt skin and noses, and Bill got blisters on his nose and lips. Their dog and cats died, and later, while mowing, he found enough dead birds to fill a hydraulic bucket half full of dead birds. Bill died during his deposition for the lawsuits, and one of the attorneys had the nerve to say it was okay because we still have his wife, Darla. Charlie Conley's cows died. The hop toads disappeared, as did the bumblebees that pollinated the clover. The cooling tower drift used to blow over his trees, and at times the leaves would turn black as desiccated. Many trees just died on his farm, and about 5 years ago, so did Charlie. On Herb Meyer's farm in New Cumberland, sheep would not dilate during birthing to deliver their young. Sometime later, a double-headed stillborn calf was born, and the vet told Herb to have it mounted because if he didn't, nobody would believe him. Herb died of thyroid cancer shortly after the 10th anniversary of the accident, and his family did not sue. 10 miles away from Three Mile Island in the northwest direction, a wave of hot air engulfed Jean Trimmer as she leaned over her porch railing calling her cat. Shortly thereafter, her skin tingled and started to itch, and later her skin appeared reddened like a week at the beach. She got tiny white bumps on her skin, and her beautiful black hair started falling out. When her hair grew back in, it had white hairs growing in a salt and pepper effect. Jean developed a rare kidney illness. During the evacuation, nurse Becky Meese's baby had projectile vomiting and severe diarrhea. The hospital in Ocean City said it could be radiation poisoning and suggested she have her car checked for contamination. She did. It was, and so was her purse. Later, her child developed cataracts and other health problems. Debbie Baker just found out that she was pregnant during the accident. She lived in the vicinity of the dentist film office where the dentist film had fogged. Debbie's son Bradley was born approximately 9 months later with Down syndrome. The lawsuit on his behalf was the largest out-of-court settlement for over $1 million. The accident at Three Mile Island was not a one-day or one-week disaster. TMI burped and vented radioactive poisons upon us during the accident and throughout the decade of cleanup. The symptoms were real. We did not imagine the metallic taste. And contrary to the NRC's opinions, we do not have hypothetical children.
That was Mary Osborne Osai speaking at the Nuclear Power and Children's Health Conference held in Chicago, October 15th and 16th. Osborne Osai continues to live in Harrisburg. She showed pictures of deformed flowers, plants, and trees that grow in her yard and the area around Three Mile Island. We're coming to you from the trenches.